Hey, morning, GB.
Good morning, Ryan. Glad to have you on the call.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Cool. Okay, so you're ready to get into the topic of our conversation today?
I'm ready to talk about the world of counting.
Nice. Very good. Well, let's get started then, and I'd like to wish everyone a good morning because it's morning here while we're doing this call. This is John Berardi, and I'm here with Ryan Andrews. And we're here today to talk, well, I guess about two things. The first is about a concept that we talk about a lot in precision nutrition called intuitive eating, and we'll get into that a little bit deeper in a few minutes. And the second concept is calorie counting. Both of these have both some really, really strong proponents, people who advocate their use, and both of them have really, really strong opponents, so people who are against their use in the nutrition world. And I wanted to just take some time today, for Ryan and I to have a chat about these two controversial areas and kind of come up with some take-home messages. In the last little while, I've noticed that for whatever reason, the calorie counting debate, as well as the intuitive eating debate, has really amped up a few notches. And there have been people writing editorials for and against these two concepts of ways to eat. There have been people who've actually come out and said that us at Precision Nutrition have got it all wrong. We don't know what we're talking about with respect to calorie counting and intuitive eating. And rather than addressing them, because that's not really how we do things here at PN, for the sake of addressing them, we wanted to get on the phone call today to make sure no one was getting confused. And quite frankly, our commitment is to our clients and our customers. As of now, we have about 47,000 clients in about 97 countries. And I can understand how with all those people interacting with us on a regular basis through the website and the member zone, it would be easy for some of them to get confused about the main important messages that we're trying to convey. So independent of small blog posts here and there, individual one-off articles, we really kind of refer people back to the Precision Nutrition System. And in this call, what I really want to do is focus on these concepts of intuitive eating and calorie counting and get to the bottom of exactly what the Precision Nutrition position is on these two things. Because I think some people have misinterpreted that, and I think it's to the detriment of all, quite frankly, because we don't like to polarize debates here. We don't like to make overgeneralizations. We simply like to talk about real nutrition for real people and how people can have success. So with my long preamble out of the way, Ryan, I'd like to actually just kick off a few ideas here that you and I have talked about before, but we've never really logged them or recorded them publicly. And maybe everyone can benefit from listening in. So for those who have the Precision Nutrition System, very specifically version 3, they know it offers a mixture of options for both those who want to calorie count. And the individualization guide actually covers calorie counting strategies, which we consider really appropriate for people at what we call level 3. And it contains options for those who don't want to calorie count. And the diet guide is a great example of that, where it uses a different system altogether. Now, from your blog posts and articles, Ryan, you're a big advocate of something called intuitive eating. And it seems that you're not really a big fan of calorie counting. Many times I've heard you advocate for listening to your body, quote unquote, whatever that means, to help control eating and food intake and to help choose better portion sizes and better food options. So let me kick out this as sort of a first question to you. What exactly does listening to your body in this context actually mean?
Yeah, in the context that I usually present it with clients, it means figuring out what cues your body provides when you're hungry and when you're not hungry.
Right.
Most of us are familiar with the cues we get for other things. We're thirsty, we're hot, we're cold, we're sleepy, we have to go to the bathroom. We have cues related to hunger as well. And we forget about them throughout life, but the true masters of this are really young children. If you ever observe the eating patterns of your children, they get hungry, they eat, they're no longer hungry, and they stop eating. They'll do this with, half a plate of dinner remaining.
Right.
So, it's something we're all capable of, and children do this without a lot of nutrition knowledge.
Right. Yeah. Now, that's a really good point. And I really like the example of children, because sometimes we get upset when they leave only half a plate or have a few bites or whatever the case is. And maybe that's where we start being socialized into eating more than we absolutely need to or should at that young age. But, you know, the question is, when we become adults, this idea of listening to our body, I mean, are there things that can screw it up?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, whenever I speak of listening to your body, you know, with eating, there's, I think, two critical factors that we have to remember. And the first one is that we only acknowledge true physiological hunger. You know,
right.
If people are getting these supposed hunger signals when they walk by the, dish full of candy at the office, or they watch a fast food commercial, or they smell the Cinnabon at the airport or something, you know, that's more of a food craving, and that's, you know, not true hunger. If we act on all those desires, we'll be eating 24 hours a day.
Right.
And the second key factor is, you know, sticking to the PN style of eating, which is real, whole, unprocessed foods. You know, if people are expecting legitimate satiety from non-food foods, I think that's a bad idea. All bets are off in that situation. So.
Yeah. So your basic distinction here is that there's a difference between psychological cravings for food or psychological hunger and physiological hunger, and we need to come up with ways to figure out the difference between them and to only listen to the physiological hunger aspect, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, I mean, this actually brings up a good point, because for those who've gone through our Lean Eating Coaching course, which is a six-month coaching course where participants are paired up with a host of coaches who can help them accomplish big body composition changes and big improvements in eating and health, we actually have a lesson where we have people toy around with the idea of physiological versus psychological hunger. There's one lesson where people have to fast, and that's always very eye-opening, because people, you know, after 24 hours of not eating, people start to actually feel what physiological hunger feels like, and they realize, whoa, this is a little bit different than what I've been listening to all along.
Yeah.
So when you say listening to your body, you're saying, hey, it's not just listening to any signal that it sends out. We're talking about physiological hunger here, and when you listen to that, you get a good response. You know, I mean, in a recent online article, I read a discussion that went like this. I think we do a lot of walking through life, and this is a quote from someone else, listening to our body signals, and I think that's exactly what the problem is. For example, when the body sends the signal that we're full of stress, It tells us to eat carbs, because that reduces our feelings of stress. When the body says we're lacking sleep, the best sort of signal that we receive is eat some carbs and drink some caffeine, so we feel a little better and get that energy burst. You know, what happens when we're depressed and anxious because of our lifestyle? Well, eating carbs is a signal that we get from the body. Another one, lacking social interaction, and this is true as well. People who do all these things, so they're stressed, they lack sleep, they're depressed, they don't get normal social interaction, they all tend to turn to carbs, specifically highly processed carbohydrates. So this person's suggestion is that we are eating intuitively, we're fulfilling the needs that our bodies feel that they have in this day and age, but we're choosing the wrong things as a result. What do you think of this, and how does your idea of intuitive eating kind of mesh with that idea, with so many people craving caffeine, sugar, processed food, as if it were actually a need?
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought up those points. You know, those are all excellent examples of what I would consider false hunger cues, and then obviously the processed foods. You mentioned, you know, stress, lack of sleep, depression, anxiety, lack of social interaction. Those, you know, I don't think those are really food issues. If people go through each day turning to, you know, a processed carb snack or something, every time a new emotion is experienced, they're likely going to have some serious health and body comp problems forever. You know, these are situations solved by changing one's life, not, you know, packing celery sticks and almonds and counting calories. It's,
right.
It's fundamental life changes.
Right.
And, you know, whether this is, you know, finding a different career or getting involved with hobbies or going outside more, whatever it is, they're voids that can't be filled with food.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, I mean, some people would say your notion here is a little bit pie in the sky, like Ryan, I can't quit my job, or I can't leave my annoying spouse, and I can't do any of these major life changes. So how do I deal with my food cravings within the context of my current stressed out, low sleep, depressed, anxious, antisocial lifestyle? You know, that's my reality, buddy. So how, you can tell me to change that, but I'm not gonna. So what do I do?
Yeah, I mean, in those situations, you can definitely find some simple alternatives. I know one you've brought up in some articles in the past. You know, it's a simple going to, green tea. Maybe somebody has, they get stressed or upset or bored or lonely or whatever it is, and they turn to green tea instead of going to those processed carbs. So, mm-hmm. I mean, you can find substitutions like that, and that's excellent. And if somebody says, wow, this is great, it's really working for me, it's helping me get through these little tough patches in throughout my day and my week, great. I think that's excellent.
Yeah, absolutely. And, when I take up that position of people receiving these other signals to eat carbs, you know, the thing that I always think about is this. We're not, that's the logical signal associated with being sleepy isn't eat carbs. It's go get some rest. You know, the logical signal to lacking social interaction isn't get some sugar. It's get some interaction. So what we're doing is we're actually replacing the real signal with a false signal. And if carbs are within arm's reach, specifically the simple sugary carbs, then we're actually just using them as a surrogate signal. So quite frankly, I'd argue against this particular author that people are not doing intuitive things in these cases where they're stressed, where they're lacking sleep, where they're depressed and anxious. What they're doing is it's a learned behavior. They've found that in the past when they were sleepy and they ate carbs and drank caffeine, it delayed the consequences associated with not getting sleep, which is feeling terrible. So they just continue to do it. To me, that's not intuitive eating. That's not listening to your body. It's basically a drug addiction. Just like people who are addicted to, hard drugs or whatever the case might be, or alcohol for the, sort of mental or social benefits that they get associated with them. They're basically just using these things as surrogates. So we can't say that people are naturally addicted to heroin, and that's your body actually has a craving for heroin before you've ever done heroin the first time. You only get those cravings when your body's become dependent on this bad drug. And in the case of food, it's the same exact thing. I mean, you and I would agree, and most people would agree, that eating too much sugar in the diet is a bad thing. Maybe not akin to doing heroin, but on a smaller level, it's obviously degrades the body. So, getting back to the main point here, I think that really what you're talking about and what we're talking about here is dissociating learned behaviors and dissociating these compulsions from actually listening to your body. And it's hard to do. There's no question about it. I mean, that's the take-home message here. However, once you do it, you are entering into a new realm of controlling your body composition, controlling your eating behaviors, controlling your eating habits in such a way that it's, once you actually figure it out, it's almost impossible not to get healthier, not to lose some body fat, not to feel better, less depressed, not to get better sleep. It's almost impossible because all these wonderful things come as a function of listening to your body signals and responding to them appropriately, not with a drug. So that's my take on it. I don't know if you have anything else to add about the intuitive eating concept.
Yeah, I think you're right on. That's exactly it.
Let's sort of segue from there, because it seems like the antithesis to intuitive eating, at least in some people's mind, is calorie counting. So the idea that rather than, making lunch, sitting down to a plate full of food, simply eating until we're full, or in the case of what I recommend to people who are interested in losing body fat, it's not eat until you're full, it's eat until you're about 80% full. And I've done a seminar quite frequently recently, where I talk about how to lose weight and de-stress. And there's a discussion in there about this concept called hara hachibu, which means eating until 80% full. And it seems that in certain countries, Okinawa has been most famous for this. The individuals there have this cultural belief. It's not a nutritional mandate. It's more of a cultural belief that if you eat more than until you're 80% full, there's something wrong with you. Like if you and I and a group of people were sitting down to dinner and I ate till I was 100% full, or like 110%, like North Americans tend to eat. They want big plates of massive heapings of food and they want seconds. If you ate that much, you're considered kind of a glutton, like a pig, you know? People would snicker and laugh at you. And so the idea here is that in Okinawa, they're some of the longest-lived peoples on the earth. They tend to have much better health than the classic Western profile. And it's partly a function of the foods that they eat, but it's partly a function of this eating until 80% full. Now, I understand if you're trying to build muscle or have very specific, you know, sports and performance goals, you don't want to follow this every time. But with that said, for average recreational exercisers who want to minimize their body fat, I think it's a great standard. A little bit of a segue, but nevertheless, I mean, if you're listening to your body cues, you sit down to lunch, you eat until you're about 80% full, then you stop eating. If you have to box something up or put it in a Tupperware for later, that's cool. And then you eat again when you're hungry next, or when you start to get initial signals of hunger. So that's one way of doing it. Now, the other alternative people suggest is if you want to get in really fantastic shape, count your calories. So, you know, go on to Fit Day, log your caloric intake for the day. Figure out how many calories are in those meals you're eating, how many proteins, how many carbs, how many fats. Weigh your foods. Use measuring cups. Do all these types of devices to quantify your energy intake. And in doing that, you can try and balance your intake and output a little better. What do you think of that approach?
Well, I think it can be helpful in certain situations. I mean, We've worked with a lot of clients at PN, and when we have somebody with a really directed, high-priority, time-specific goal related to body composition, you know, whether they're going to do a physique contest or they have a weight class they need to get ready for, they're doing a beauty pageant or a body transformation competition, then I think calorie counting can be very effective. You know, that describes a small, you know, segment of the population, and even then, I think the calorie counting should be done probably by a nutritionist or a trainer or a nutrition professional and not necessarily left up to the athlete.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that wholeheartedly. There's not a single one of my clients at the high level of sport performance that counts their calories themselves. I am aware of how many calories they're taking in, and I help plan their nutritional intake. And so what they get is they get a list of foods to eat. And, you know, truth be told, it's not like they're completely ignorant of serving sizes. Their plans have recommended serving sizes. You know, I mean, simply put, if I said eat some meat for lunch, that wouldn't get the job done. Their first question would be how much meat? And so, you know, it usually says things like about 4 ounces, about 6 ounces, about 8 ounces based on body size. So, you know, when we say our athletes don't calorie count, it doesn't mean they don't measure anything, and it doesn't mean that they're unaware of the food that they're taking in. You know, I think that's how people set this up in their brains. You either count and measure, or you're an ignoramus floating through life not knowing anything. And it's simply not that polar opposite. Quite frankly, you do need to have some food awareness. And like I said, with my, I think your point is fantastic. If you need to be more calorie aware and do energy intake versus output balancing structures, the best way to do that is actually work with a professional to do it. It's the same thing as, you know, if you don't know anything about fixing cars and you just start popping the hood of your car and trying to fix stuff or tweak stuff or make it run better, I'm not quite sure that's the best idea unless you want to risk screwing something up or hurting yourself in the process. And that's what we're talking about here. Now, you know, people may say something like, well, I can't afford to hire a nutritionist, and that's a legitimate concern. What can I do instead? I want that same level of care that Ryan and John's elite athlete clients get, so, but I can't afford to hire Ryan and John, so what do I do?
Yeah, I mean, in those situations, they can develop their own strategy. I mean, that's when it's nice to have something like a guide to follow, you know, like Precision Nutrition, and not just, you know, randomly start tinkering with calories. And, you know, because what, you know, people get these calorie numbers in their head. They say, I have to eat 1,200 a day. Where do they get that? You know, is that something they read in a magazine, or is that something they heard from their friend at the beauty salon or something? You know,
right.
There's a systematic way of doing it. So it's not just something you kind of start guessing and playing around with.
Right, right. And so, I mean, there is, you know, one thing that we, like I said, in Precision Nutrition, we're not pro or anti-calorie counting. We're not pro or anti-intuitive eating. In fact, there's a whole guide devoted to, you know, intuitive eating. There's a whole guide devoted to following recipes instead of counting calories. And then there's a guide to actually systematically planning out, you know, how much you need for your specific activities, your body type, and the amount of calories you're taking in. And the truth is, it's that's the most challenging and difficult thing to do. And, you know, taking a straw poll of every single person who works with Precision Nutrition, you know, you, me, Phil, Aaron, Amanda, all the people part of our team, not a single one of us counts calories as defined by getting one of those really cool weigh scales that tells you the amount of calories in X ounces of whatever food you put on it at the time, meticulously plotting out our dietary intake, etc. None of us do that. Now, the question is this. Did we ever do that? Did you ever do that? I mean, Ryan, you're not just some touchy-feely psychological nutritionist here. You actually won bodybuilding championships. Did you ever count calories?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, a little. I think I really developed the calorie awareness more than anything. I mean, I always had a trainer and a nutritionist that, you know, they told me what to eat getting ready for a contest. So,
right.
You know, I was definitely aware. It's hard not to be when you're involved with a physique sport. But, you know, I didn't necessarily tally up my count for the day. It was more of I really developed an awareness of the foods that were high energy density versus low energy density, the ones that helped me reach my goals with body comp, the ones that didn't, that type of thing. So, yeah, definitely, the awareness is there.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I'll admit wholeheartedly that in the very beginning of my journey in physique sport, this is when I was competing as a bodybuilder as well, I did count things. You know, I got into the gadgets. I weighed out my foods. I made sure I was eating X grams or X cups of this, that, and the other thing. And I knew what my calorie totals were by the end of the day. With that said, I've seen some people take it to an extreme that was very, very different than what I was doing. And I mean, I was winning national championships, so this I wasn't just tinkering around with this. I was at a fairly elite level. Because nowadays I see some people literally just putting their food into a program like Fit Day every single day, plotting it over time, making charts and graphs. To me, it's not that that's bad. If your natural inclination is to be a chart and graph person, I guess it's okay. The only thing is, I find that it sort of tends to take away from a healthy appreciation of food. And food simply becomes numbers. And the problem with that is, people get sick of that after a while, and they eventually can create disordered behaviors with respect to eating. It can create fear of food, fear of calories, fear of carb grams. I can't tell you how many times someone has come back and said, oh, I saw this meal that you ate, JB, and it had 150 grams of carbs in it. Isn't that too much? And the question is always, too much for what? It's clearly not too much for me. Last time I did my body fat, I was, you know, between 6 and 8%. So there's this, you know, standard that they have in their brains when they start counting that a certain number is too much, a certain number is too little, and those numbers might be completely arbitrary. And the only way that you could fall into that trap of coming up with arbitrary standards is to be meticulous about counting and having, you know, setting these rules for yourselves. Now, with that said, it doesn't mean I'm a calorie counting antagonist. I learned very, very early on my entire paradigm of food awareness was based on early, I call it early onset calorie counting, right? So when I started, I was doing calorie counting for a brief period of time. But my argument is that if you were to just weigh and measure food for the first few weeks of a new nutrition regimen, or, you know, learning about nutrition and fitness, within those few weeks, you would be able to look at a chicken breast, a handful of broccoli, a handful of pasta, and know relatively how many grams or ounces or cups that is without doing all the complicated measurements, and you'd be able to guesstimate portion sizes based on eyeballing things. And then if you're objective and honest with yourself, which is kind of a big requirement, then for the rest of your life, you'll know exactly about what your portion size would be. And then rather than counting calories and saying, oh, today I got 1,200, tomorrow I need to do better, whatever better means, more or less, you simply eat according to these eyeballed portion sizes, and then if you're not losing at the rate you want to lose, you just take a few calories out, take some food out. Let me just ask you this question. I just want to hear your answer to this. What is the most important determinant of weight loss or weight gain?
Well, energy balance. I mean, anybody that's been trained, I think, you know, in nutrition and works with weight management clients knows it's energy balance. And the key there, though, what we've been talking about so far is how you go about achieving the energy balance.
Yeah.
You know, is it just counting? Is it, you know, reading more about it or learning more? Is it dealing with, you know, how you've progressed so far? It's how you get to that point of energy balance.
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, quite frankly, if the answer is energy balance, which it is, I mean, the foods that you choose, they are important. The nutrient timing, that's important. But the ultimate determinant of weight loss and weight gain is energy balance. And if it is energy balance, doesn't it follow that we should logically control energy balance by counting calories?
Yeah, you'd think so, but I like to use an analogy with money management. We're all familiar with how we manage our money. If we want to balance our finances, you know, and save money for the future, then we just need to set a detailed budget and count where all of our money goes.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, none of us would have any debt. But last time, you know, I looked at some debt statistics in America. You know, the average American household carried about $8,000 in credit card debt, and, you know, half of families spend more than they earn.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so food, like money, we start to deal with emotions. It's not just the counting. It sounds good on paper,
mm-hmm.
but when you start to get into the experience of choosing things and having the emotional influence of everything, we overvalue the immediate gains versus, you know, future expenses and future costs to our decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a great point. You know, and this is where the, sort of the fork branches in the road, because what you're doing is you're saying, hey, man, we got to be realistic here. People don't balance their budgets, and they don't balance their calories. They're simply not going to do it on, like, when you take an average of the entire population. Now, someone on the other side of the fence might argue that's exactly why the people who are wealthy balance their budgets. The people who actually succeed financially balance their budget, just like the people who actually succeed nutritionally balance their calories. That would be one argument. Now, I have a rebuttal to that, which is I've seen thousands of people succeed nutritionally without counting calories. But maybe, rather than this being a calorie counting versus intuitive eating debate, maybe what this is a different approaches for different steps in your path. For me, I actually think doing a little bit of food, whatever we can call them, food awareness exercises. So taking extra time at the grocery store, reading nutrition labels at the beginning of your journey, measuring your food, doing a little bit of weighing, that sort of thing to figure out, I mean, what does 1,000 calories look like in a day? You and I know that, but someone new to this game doesn't know it at all. They have no clue.
Yeah.
They don't know if it's one apple or 100 apples. So maybe in the beginning, at least this is what I think, doing food awareness exercises is really, really valuable. However, after a short period of time, continuing to do those exercises may be an exercise in futility, and it may be an exercise in obsessive-compulsive disorder. It may be just simply too much. Once you get to a certain point of awareness, you're not enforcing more awareness down the line by continuing to do it. What you may be doing is actually enforcing unhealthy behaviors and habits. So, you know, that's sort of my take on it. Now, I don't know if you feel the same way or if you actually have a different take.
No, yeah, I agree with you. I think, you know, when people start to go from this purely, you know, I'm just kind of eating on how I feel to I'm going to count, you know, calories and be 100% rigid with everything and it's all, you know, governed by my intellectual control. You know, when it kind of shifts from that physiologic listening to body to 100% cognitive control, when people get in that situation, any sort of agitation, like a deviation from the plan or, you know, life happens, work hours come up, family concerns, emotional concerns, that can lead to some out-of-control eating when it's only governed by your intellect. And
right.
So when that happens, then people say, okay, well, I'm kind of out of control of my eating since it was all governed by my intellect. Now I need to restrain again. So they start calorie counting again. Mm-hmm. And then they're restricted, but then they overeat again, and then they restrict. So it kind of spurs that whole feast and famine cycle that a lot of people are familiar with, which was all spurred, and the whole cascade of events began by that shift from getting kind of obsessive compulsive with your intellectual control of eating.
Well, you know, the truth is, you and I have actually shared stories in the past about us actually achieving that state of intellectual control and the repercussions and rebound effects associated with that. And I think that's where this becomes very interesting because you and I have enough experience in this field. I mean, I've been doing this for a long time now. I've been working with clients for a long time, and I've worked with a lot of them. And once you work with people for a very long duration, I mean, I don't know how many nutrition coaches or trainers have ever had the opportunity to work with a client for 10 years straight. I mean, that's a pretty outstanding thing. Yeah. And I don't mean it on my part. I just mean in terms of experiential value. So when you have a lot of clients and you've worked with them for a very long time, you can go through the peaks and valleys with them and the changes in life experience and the changes in what they're being dealt on a daily basis from the rest of life. And what I've learned from that is that it's almost like that song, there's a time for everything, you know? There's probably a time for counting, and that may be at the very beginning where you need to learn food awareness. And then after that, maybe the time is for intuitive eating. And then maybe with intuitive eating, you get into really great shape. And you want to do a physique contest. And maybe at that point, there's a time for a little more strict control, counting. And then once that's over, it's time to get back to intuitive. So there's no easy answers here. I mean, just like anything else in life, there's a lot of ways to do things. But the reason there's a lot of ways is not because you just willy-nilly choose whatever feels right. There's a lot of ways because there's a lot of different scenarios and situations that require different solutions. And so, for me, I think both solutions, intuitive eating and calorie counting, are very valid. But you have to know when to use them, when each tool is appropriate. And for me, you know, coming up with this idea that we have to decide right now which one works and which one doesn't is absurd. And that leads to just simply overgeneralizations. It leads to this disease of the professional, which is what I call it, where we think everyone's the same. Where we think the same we use this one strategy, whether it's intuitive eating or calorie counting, and we just apply it to everyone. And that's absurd. There are individual differences. People are different points along the path. That's why in precision nutrition we use level 1, 2, and 3, because then we can actually isolate people into the group that's most relevant to them and use the strategies that are most important for someone at that level. And you can only develop those with years and years of experience following people for a lot of years. I mean, with some of my Olympic athletes, I've got not only experience working with them for 10 years, I've got physiological data for 10 years. And, I mean, we don't, I didn't collect detailed psychological measures, but in our interactions, I get a feel for their psychology. So it's pretty interesting to me, I mean, how this whole thing works. And the, you know, the truth is, for me, at least my truth, is that there's different times for applying different tools, and both tools, intuitive eating and calorie counting, are both very valid. So that's kind of my take on it.
Yeah, I that summed it up really, really well. I think, you know, different times call for different strategies. So yeah. You got to find what works for you at that time.
Yeah. Now, I mean, playing devil's advocate here, you know. Nevertheless, I mean, I know that you on our forum and your blog tend to talk a lot more about intuitive eating than you do about calorie counting. So Is that an indication of what the ratio of intuitive eating to calorie counting periods in one's life should be?
I write a lot of my blogs and articles, and they're inspired a lot by the interactions I have with clients I've worked with in the past and who I work with currently.
And let me interrupt. I want to hear what you have to conclude with there. But let's just put it into perspective here for people listening in. Everyone can say that they've worked with clients, and you know, to them, clients might mean two people that are their cousin and uncle that they've told to eat certain things. So let's clarify what exactly your experience is. I know most people will know where you come from and what you do, but let's just say that now. So, I mean, when you say clients, what type of people have you worked with and do you work with?
A majority of my clients have been weight management. I mean, I did my nutrition internship at Johns Hopkins, so I got to work with hundreds of clients during that experience, and then I was actually hired on at their weight management center, so I got to work at the Johns Hopkins Weight Management Center and work exclusively with weight management clients for just about 15 months. And then after that, I joined the PN team and have worked with a whole host of different, you know, different clients, a lot of it related to body composition management. So
yeah.
I was trying to think the other day about how many. I think it's got to be over 1,000 people now. So
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Just through our lean eating, and you're a pretty modest guy, but I also know which elite Olympic athletes that you're working with right now too, and there's no small cohort of those, and not only are they high level athletes, I mean these are gold medalists and multiple world champions. So it spans the whole gamut. I'm sure you've worked with people 400 pounds. All the way up to the most elite level of athlete. So I just wanted to clarify that for people listening in, because sometimes it's real easy for people to throw around, well, my experience with my clients, blah, blah, blah. But with that said, I mean, there are different levels of experience, and quite frankly, I think you've achieved one of the highest levels of experience with clients. So anyway, so you're talking about how in your experience with clients, relative to the balance between counting and intuitive eating. So go ahead.
Yeah, it's just been really interesting as you interact with people. I find that the people that tend to get the most, you know, really obsessed and the best calorie counters usually have some of the worst nutrition habits and some of the most body fat. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know exactly if it's that's what's caused it or what's going on, or if they're just purely out of touch with how they feel when they eat and it's all about numbers, what's happening. I think a lot of it's what I talked about early about that they've shifted really from listening to their body, which was kind of incorrect with what they were doing early in life, but they went 100% to, you know, I'm going to govern this by entering my numbers in Fit Day. And it's all intellectual, and then it creates, you know, that feast and famine, that restriction, that overeating cycle. And over the course of years, I mean, that just leads to more and more body fat. So, when people kind of enter that world, it can get a little scary.
Yeah, and so you're suggesting that what happens is they get all intellectual about it, so they restrict their calories so that they'll lose fat. And so they say, I'm going to eat 1,000 or 1,200 calories a day, and they stick with that. And it requires a large degree of discipline and quite frankly, a lot of control, lifestyle control. I mean, you've got to be in situations where you can eat the types of foods that you've intellectually told yourself you have to eat, that are on your menu plan, etc. And then what happens? I mean, stress comes up, or something happens at work, or something happens with your family, or you go on vacation, and now you don't have Fit Day. You don't have the exact foods that were on your nutrition plan, and or you simply don't feel like intellectualizing this thing because emotions get in the way, and you gain a lot of fat, rebound fat. So you're saying that can be prevented. How?
Well, I think when we really tune in more to getting that feedback from our body, and it makes more sense to us if we can say, you know what, I'm gonna stop eating because I feel, you know, no longer hungry. I'm satisfied. Mm-hmm. That taps into our emotional brain. You know, that makes more sense than I have to stop eating because I've reached my calorie quota.
Right.
You know, it's a little bit harder for our emotional brain to kind of take hold of that and roll with it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, when you can really harness the more emotional side of it, it can last a little bit longer and not get you into some of those feast and famine behaviors.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Now, there's going to be people listening in who say, you know what, Ryan, I mean, that's good, and I can see how lazy, uneducated, weak-minded people would fall prey to those habits, but I'm not like that. So, your whole idea about coddling people with these psychological devices is only for weak people. So I'm not going to listen to this at all. I'm just going to go back to counting my calories because I'm not going to fall victim to those problems you talk about. I mean, would you have an answer for them?
Well, for them, I would point out to what they're doing. You know, how's your experience right now and their relationship with eating and food on a daily basis? Is it something they can sustain? Is it something that's working for them? Are they happy with the results? Are they happy with life outside of the results? I mean, is it restricting them in other areas of life? You know, and I like to turn it on to how they're actually doing, because if they're having success, I'm not going to, you know, try to get them in, you know, on another path. Why would I? I have no incentive to do that. So, yeah, I mean, if they're having success with a strategy and they're meeting their goals, then go ahead and continue that strategy.
You know, and that's true. That's one of the things I always love about your advice, Ryan. It's that you're not trying to evangelize. You're not trying to tell people what you're doing is wrong. You got to do it my way. It's basically, what are you doing? How is that working? Okay, if it's not working very well, I've got some strategies that can help. If it is working very well, then God bless. I hope it continues to. If anything ever happens, give me a shout and I'll help you work through it. And that's one of my favorite things about you. That's one of my favorite things about the advice that people get on the Precision Nutrition Member Zone. All of our coaches and moderators share the same thing. And quite frankly, I think it's trickled down from some of the stuff you're doing. I mean, a lot of them look up to you and your experience, and so they look at how you kind of handle these situations and say, wait a second, this seems like the best way to do it. Rather than taking, you know, drawing hard lines in the sand and saying, no, it's got to be this way. If you don't do it this way, get the hell out of our community, which I've seen, quite frankly, happen elsewhere on the internet. So, I think that's really fantastic advice. And you know, at this point, I think it would be actually a good time, unless you've got any other things to add, to wrap up the call. So is there any other points you want to kind of add in before we come up with some concluding statements?
No, I think we covered a good amount of information. Yeah, I think we can probably get some good take-home points, though, here to wrap
up
the call.
Yeah, so let me just ask you this. What are your concluding statements? What is your bottom line here? Because ultimately, I don't care to get into intellectual debates about nutrition habits and food. I really care about helping people overcome their nutritional challenges. That's what I care about, and I know with 100% certainty that's how you feel about it too. So rather than leaving this call with sort of like a big question mark, what's better intellectually, what are the concluding messages that you can give, thinking about the person that actually is a client of ours who needs help? What's the concluding statement to help them cut through all this BS? Because if they go listen to someone else's conversation that has a different opinion than us, or read an article that someone says that may differ from what we're saying here, or may misinterpret what we're saying here, how can they make sense of it? How can they figure out what to do? Because that's really what it's all about. It's not what you think. It's what are you doing? And is that working? So how do you make sense of that? What can we leave people with?
As we've been talking today, I jotted down a few different points here. So I'll give you my take-home points
because
you brought up a lot of good thoughts. I have, just about seven. So
okay.
These are my seven take-home points. The first I would say, and you mentioned this early, is listening to your body is anything but easy. And, you know, we don't want to advocate that, oh, yeah, it's this really easy, new, fun approach or anything like that. It's not easy at all, especially when we've unlearned it throughout life. You know, there's a big difference between being full and being no longer hungry, like the 80% thing you mentioned. So that's mm-hmm. my first point. Second point is it's important to accept the feeling of hunger. You know, this feeling isn't going anywhere, and nor would that be a good thing. Hunger plays, you know, a vital biological function. So that's number two. Number three, don't make nutrition more complicated than it needs to be. If we focus on real foods and how we feel after eating those real foods, that's what listening to the body is all about. The fourth point I have, nutritious foods are good for you. And when we eat enough of them, it helps us control some of those cravings for overeating the lousy foods. The fifth take-home point I have, people that become preoccupied with calorie counting tend to become more and more out of touch with their body. So, you know, anything that doesn't work into the spreadsheet for the day is off limits, and it kind of becomes that whole deprivation mindset that we talked about earlier. Sixth point, we know that true physiological hunger can be satisfied with a moderate amount of real food. Our stomach grumbles, we get irritable, you know, and the bowl of, you know, vegetables sounds amazing. Great. However, we have the emotional hunger and the head hunger we talked about, and that arises from just the need to feel better. And it's, you know, it's insatiable. Food isn't the problem here. It's not going to fill up that void. And then, you know, my final point, and you mentioned this earlier, and I love this point, if we focus on how we feel as the goal rather than just on fat loss, we usually find, ironically, that we can't help but get into better shape. Mm-hmm. So those are my seven drawn-out take-home points. I'll turn it over to you.
Well, actually, I was going to kind of come up with my own to conclude with, but those are so fantastic. I don't think I can follow them up with much. Although people who know me know that I can follow up pretty much anything and talk a lot. My only concluding point. I love every single point that you just put out there, and maybe we should actually write them up and put them into an upcoming newsletter because I think they're that valuable and people should be revisiting them. But my sort of take-home point, and it dovetails really nicely with what you're saying, is this. There are no shortcuts here. Whether you're listening to your body or whether you're calorie counting, both of them are tough. Getting in shape is tough. It's not impossible. It's not miserable. It's not brutal, as some people would have you believe. It just requires a change. So it's not fitness that's hard. It's not eating better that's hard. It's change that's hard. Any change in life is hard. And that's what we're talking about here. If you're not happy with who you are, if you're not happy with your body composition as it stands, if you're not happy with how you feed your body every single day and how you feel about it and how you feel energy-wise, then you need to make some changes, and it's not going to be easy to do that, but it's a requirement. So then what do you do? And quite frankly, I think nutrition tends to take care of itself a lot of the time if you're doing a proper exercise program first, if you're managing stress second, and then you're just simply choosing the best foods third. And, you know, for people who are like, hey, JB, live in the real world. People aren't doing this stuff. Well, that's the problem then. Calorie counting isn't the answer to a problem of no exercise, a problem of high stress and no way of coping with that. Calorie counting, in many cases, will just make that whole cycle worse. So, again, I'm not coming out against it, but what I am saying is this. There's a pathway here, and the pathway is move. Start moving the body. The body's meant for movement. It has to move. This isn't about energy balance. It's about triggering key genes, so genetic processes, and physiological processes that help the body balance out weight and energy better. That's what exercise triggers. So we got to do it, and we got to do it right, first level. Second level, manage stress. People forget this one all the time. If you manage stress appropriately, you are managing hormones of your body, I call it sympathetic to parasympathetic balance. A lot of what we do, a lot of the stress we have, even our weight training and high-intensity intervals, are all sympathetic stressors. And we need parasympathetic activation. And I've written about this and I've spoken about this to balance that out. And the interesting thing is once we get those two things checked out, the food becomes a lot easier. A lot of our cravings go away. A lot of those sort of addictions start to disappear. And then we can just get to the things that we talk about with good nutrition, which are eating whole natural foods, eating until 80% full, et cetera, et cetera. And that's, I think, the baseline from where almost everyone should start. That's where they should begin good nutrition. Now, let's say they want to do a physique competition in 12 weeks. Well, then there you can get a little more strict. You can start counting. You can start plugging in your calories if you need to, although, quite frankly, I've seen people succeed without doing it. But that's where that comes in for me. I think the real idea here and what you've been talking about and what we talk about in PN for at least a portion of it is that once you get in touch with your body, once you start treating it the way that it's supposed to be treated, and it's not that hard to do this, a lot of this stuff comes easy. A lot of the stress goes away. It becomes natural to be healthy and fit. So those are the concluding points that I want to leave the call with. Anything last from you?
No, that was excellent. I love this call. There was a lot of good information. Thanks for setting it up.
Yeah, no problem, Ryan, and I really appreciate your thoughts on the matter, and I'm excited to put this up on the site and let people listen to it for our next newsletter. So thank you.
All right, thanks. Sounds good.
Okay, later.